Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in the San Diego Performance Academy.
The Federal Aviation Administration has announced it is tightening up regulations of foreign pilots training in the United States after several crashes and after some instructors blew the whistle on safety concerns. An investigative report by an NBC TV station in the Bay Area raised questions over whether foreign pilots are getting enough training time in the cockpit. This all adds fuel to concerns raised by East County residents over the safety of foreign pilot training right here at Gillespie Field. In the U.S., pilots train for years either in the military or general aviation or both to gain at least 1,500 hours of flight time before they're allowed into the cockpit of a commercial jetliner. But the FAA has given out over 4,800 licenses to foreign pilots last year alone, pilots who came here from Asia or other places to train, many of them with zero flight experience. Now, the FAA has announced new requirements for training of foreign pilots following the crash of a Continental flight into a house in Buffalo, New York. That plane was flown by a recent graduate of the Aviation Cooperation Program. The crash killed 49 people and was attributed to pilot error. An Asiana flight that crashed in San Francisco occurred after two new graduates of the Foreign Pilots Program set the speed too low for landing. Transpac Aviation Academy in Arizona, which trains foreign pilots, has had three separate fatality accidents in recent years. Flight schools have also had numerous non-fatality accidents, heightening safety concerns. NBC interviewed an instructor who said he quit his job over safety lapses and that instructors were pressured by flight schools and foreign airlines to pass students who were not ready. Within a year, the students were flying wide-body commercial airliners. A second instructor called the process an indecent hurry to graduate students. Student training typically lasts a year or less, with 180 to 200 hours of flight time in U.S. flight schools, followed by 40 to 60 hours of more flight time back in their homelands overseas. Sue Strom heads up Advocates for Safe Airport Policies, or SAFE, a citizens group in East County that has been advocating for more attention paid to safety and a halt to training of foreign pilots at Gillespie Field. She says ASAP has been concerned for years that our freedom to enjoy our clear skies and livable communities has been preempted by the little-known Aviation Cooperation Program run by the FAA to train international students over our neighbors. Strom added that the latest news proves that we are not alone. Scandinavian Aviation Academy in El Cajon trains foreign pilots from China. The flight school has been involved in its own share of issues. Back in 2006, a Cessna owned by the academy collided with another plane and crashed over a residential area in El Cajon and La Mesa, killing three people. More recently, neighbors have complained of low flight patterns over homes near Gillespie Field as the academy has boosted its enrollment of Chinese student pilots, although the academy has denied the low flights. The new FAA requirements aim to improve pilots' ability to manually fly the planes, including handling mid-air stalls and wind gusts. The FAA also ordered tracking and remedial training for pilots with inadequate performances, as well as training for better pilot monitoring and improved runway safety procedures. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we're going to be talking about safety issues at Gillespie Field, and my guests are all from Advocates for Safe Airport Policy, or ASAP, Sue Strom, David Britton, and Betty Chavez. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Now, you've all lived in the Fletcher Hills area near the airport for many, many, many years, and of course, the airport was there when you bought, but recently, things have changed. Let's start with you, Sue. Tell me, how are things different now than when you first moved into the neighborhood?
I've lived in Fletcher Hills since 1977, and the airport that is here now was not the airport that was there when we moved. It was a mom-and-pop general aviation airport. It has now become an international flight training school.
So how often do you have flights over your house on a daily basis? How noisy is it?
It's very noisy, and more than that, there's never a time when you come home, you drive into your garage, you get out of your car, and you hear that familiar droning, and you know what it's coming from. I can tell you that the flights, since we've monitored them, we probably, at a minimum, have 90 flights every day, but it averages
90 every single day over your house.
That's a minimum, Miriam. We're talking probably 140 to 160 a day.
A lot.
David Britton has gotten up to 200.
Wow.
This is on camera, this is on audio, so we're not pulling these numbers out of the air, so to speak.
Now, David is a Top Gun school graduate. He's been an air traffic controller as well, so you know a lot about aviation. Tell us what your research has found.
What my research has found is for the last 18 months, I have been video recording all planes that flies in the South Pattern Gillespie, basically, essentially over Fletcher Hills.
Right, and this came about because critics of the group had been saying that you were exaggerating, that there weren't really that many flights.
And in filming the traffic from the moment they start flying until the moment they stop flying, some nights, many nights after the tower has closed. But in summary, filming from day in to day out, at the end of the day, what I do is reconstruct all planes that have flown in a pattern. And in my reconstruction, there's several things that I take away from it. One is the number of touch and go by plane in the pattern throughout the day. And it essentially tells me what plane is in the pattern by tail number, how many times that plane entered that pattern. And what I have observed is a handful of planes, roughly 20 to 25 planes from seven flying academies, knocking off repeatedly in just the south pattern. And I'm not talking the north pattern combined, but just the south pattern alone, anywhere from 90, 120, 130, 140 touch and goes repeatedly. And these planes are coming and going two and three times a day, bouncing from one pattern to the other pattern, or out to the reservoirs and back out to the farmland and back in the touch and go pattern. So it's just a handful of planes doing the same thing repeatedly all day, all night.
Yeah, and these are student pilots practicing these touch and goes. This is not, say, an experienced pilot flying
no,
in from
these
someplace
not
else.
Recreational or pilots or sub-qual, and these are cadets that are on a compressed program completing their license within a 10-month period of time.
So, David, you began monitoring the actual number of flights, type of flights, largely because there was criticism of this group from those that said that you must be exaggerating, there couldn't possibly be this many flights. Tell me what you found.
What I found, I have been recording and monitoring Gillespie almost 2 years.
With video?
With video, audio, video recording, and more intently the last 18 months. And what I have found, and I video record the planes more so in the south pattern, largely because of an accident that occurred over my home in 1997.
Yeah, now you have a very personal interest in this. Tell me what happened at your own house.
Yes. In 97, if we just quickly on that accident, which is what started the metering and the monitoring of what was going on at Gillespie.
Yeah, you got the call that parent wants to get, right?
Yes, exactly. I'm a father that received a phone call from the head of the household saying there's been an accident overhead our house. And, oh, by the way, yes, we are okay. Debris
That's
a little
great.
Bit everywhere. But there have been a fatality involving an international student that it nose section landed in the house behind us, tail section in the driveway,
wow.
Three doors down from
Terrifying.
Us. So that is how quickly we forget. As a defense contractor coming off of a contract in October 2012, November 2012, sort of taking a month off there, get some sun, fun in the backyard here in El Cajon, and lo and behold, one plane right after another overhead of the house, and that's what started the metering and monitoring.
Yeah, you've likened the noise to the speedway.
Exactly. And following this, when we first moved in the area, in the house that we're still living in now, 22 years ago, I could hear the old El Cajon Speedway at a distance. But now, when you look at the noise as it applies to these single-engine, pistol-driven Cherokees and Cessnas that is running behind it, tail chasing each other 15, 20 seconds apart, cutting the corner at 18 seconds, 3 to 4, 5 planes in the patterns all at the same time. Basically, from an analogy aspect, the old El Cajon Speedway is now the Cajon Speedway over our head.
In the sky.
In the sky, you know, rotating left and right.
Betty.
Yes.
You've lived in the area a number of years as well. Tell me what the situation is like at your house. And also, I understand you were among the first to try to take some action about this back in 2005, 2006. What happened?
Yes, at the end of 2005, I was trying to speak with somebody in my backyard. Found I couldn't. There were planes coming over all the time. And this continued, and I went around, talked to my neighbors. I thought maybe I was the only one. And I found that I wasn't the only one. I ended up taking a petition around the neighborhood. Hundreds of people signed it. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't. It wasn't my imagination. Because of the way the pattern, if you want to call it a pattern, is flown, sometimes they fly something like the pattern. Sometimes they cut that pattern very short. Mm-hmm. And the pattern is over neighborhoods. It's
correct.
Not over commercial buildings.
Now, David, in researching this, many of these students that are training at Gillespie now are actually from overseas, from China and around the U.S. There's an entire program aimed at bringing in foreign students to train to be airline pilots. Can you tell us about the history of that program and how did that happen?
The program that's currently taking place at Gillespie right now is part of the United States Bilateral Aviation Cooperation Program, ACP, that was signed between the United States and China, and it has been evolving since 2005. Officially really signed out by the United States Trade Department Agency in 2012 was when the letter was signed between U.S. and China to develop China's aviation sector.
So how many of these foreign students are there now, do you know, in this ACP program in the United States, and how many of them are at Gillespie?
I don't know specifically how many is at Gillespie, but I will tell you there's a work order for 50,000 pilots within 8 years being trained.
That's a lot of pilots. Now, the safety concerns have increased recently. Just within the last couple of months, there's been some crashes. There was a crash in New York where a foreign student under this program crashed a plane into a house, and another one in San Francisco that was a student pilot that crashed, and both of those were found to be pilot error. Now, I understand that the Scandinavian Aviation Academy at Gillespie, while it has not had a crash here that I'm aware of, their parent company has had some crashes. Sue, can you tell me a little bit about that? What's their record been like?
Their sister or parent company is called Transcom, and they just had a major crash in Arizona.
A couple of them, actually.
Yes. This goes back to really, I would say, June, July time frame.
Yeah, and these were fatality accidents.
These were fatality.
Right.
Four instructors, two students
wow.
involved. And because of the density and intensity that these classes and academies tend to fly at,
yeah.
not one student and one like me when I was training to become a pilot. I was a 40-hour pilot, flew based on funding and created enthusiasm as it applied to my wallet.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because in the United States, until recently, anybody who was training to become a pilot of a commercial jetliner already had a lot of flight experience before they ever got into the cockpit of a commercial jetliner or into a classroom situation. They had trained in the military typically for many hours. But these students that are coming from overseas, many of them have never been in a cockpit at all before. The first time they've even been in a plane, some of them is flying over here to go to pilot school. So, you know, how concerned are you about that?
I'm very concerned. And the concern is expressed from the monitoring of the activities that take place in the pattern, that we're going to call it, mm-hmm. for the purpose of lack of mm-hmm. speedway right now. And similar to what Betty and others are expressing in concern, because of the different configuration and type of aircrafts, pilots' level of experience, you take a brand new young individuals in the cockpit for the first time. So not everybody's going to come out and fly that plane professionally. So what we are experiencing in the Sullivan pattern or individuals in the cockpit for the first beginners, nuggets as we call them in the military, pilots that are qualified and training over our homes and practicing developing that expertise.
NBC in the San Francisco area, after the crash up there, they did an investigation and they had some really troubling information. They interviewed some flight instructors who spoke to them under condition their identities, you know, were protected. But they said that they were being pressured by these foreign airlines and by some of the flight schools to graduate students who really were not qualified, who didn't know how to land a plane if there was problems with the instruments, who pretty much relied on instrument control, and that these students were getting out of these schools and going back overseas and being put almost right into the cockpit of commercial jetliners. Sue, as a resident, how troubling is that to you to have pilots that aren't very experienced flying repeatedly over your house?
I'm very troubled by it on many levels. First of all, just the amount, the number is statistically, it's not if it's going to happen, it's when it's going to happen.
Right.
The proliferation of these schools and the flights over our heads is troubling, not only because of the burning leaded avgas. Look at the top of my patio. You can look at our neighbor's shrubbery covered with black tar.
So lead pollution is
definitely just your health and the air you're breathing. But getting back to the actual safety of it, yeah, there's an accident waiting to happen.
Now, there's also been an issue with the lack of English skills of many of these pilots coming over. Many of them speak no English when they arrive. I think they're required to learn some very minimal level. But we have a letter in hand from a pilot who talks about overhearing some of these conversations between air traffic control and some of these pilots. He said they were near misses because the pilots did not understand the instructions that the air traffic control tower was giving them. So I'd like to move on. We've identified, I guess, what the problems are. I'd like to hear from each of you what you think the solution is. First of all, there's been some who've said, you guys are just anti-airport, you don't want an airport there at all. Would you like to respond to that?
I will respond to that, and I have responded to it frequently, and I think it's sad that people are really trying to cloud the issue. ASAP, Advocates for Safe Airport Policies, we are not trying to close the airport. We are asking for enforceable rules, and we are asking for the curtailment of student flight training over our neighborhoods. And let me add, when I say enforceable rules, because of the ANCA Act in 1990, and because Gillespie Field receives federal funding, there are no rules. There is no curfew.
Wow.
There are no emissions controls. There is no one in the tower after 9 o'clock at night. Anything they do is voluntary, and they're not doing it very well.
David, at the federal level, I understand that, you know, to change this, there's certain things that the county could do if it chose to, and there's other things that are beyond the county's control because of these federal treaties or federal trade agreements. Can you tell me a little bit about, let's start with the federal level. I understand there's been some talk, you've been meeting with federal legislators about the possibility of some federal legislation to make changes at that level.
At the federal level, changes should be relooked at the 2006 annex that specifies we will conduct bilateral agreements in our airspace indefinitely.
So right now, this could go on forever unless that
until we go back in at the federal level and revisit the annex that was signed that reads for the conduct of these bilateral agreements will be indefinite in America's class Delta airspace.
Mm-hmm.
It is going to continue. That's at the federal level.
Now, at the county level, the county gets a lot of money from the federal government for the airports. So they're a little bit between a rock and a hard place. But what could the county do to
make this? At the county level, they could do two things. One, what they're doing right now, which is continuing to do the same thing, and we're continuing to get the same results that we've been getting all along. The other thing that the county can do is, without a whole lot of permission, including permission from the federal government, is enact pay-as-you-go user fees, and that will start weaning the county off of the dependency on the Federal Aviation Administration aviation improvement program money that they're receiving on an annual basis that lock you into an airport for the next 20 years.
So if they were to go with this user fee, which would make the airport self-sustaining ideally and not dependent on the federal government, what options would the county have? Would they be able to enact, you know, more regulations, more restrictions, say they don't want to train foreign pilots? I mean, what could they do if that were to happen?
In that case, what I believe, just the user fees would act as a deterrent. You either pay the cost to fly in San Diego compared to Oklahoma City this morning, which is under ice. So you should be, if you're going to be as competitive as everybody else, by the way, San Diego is not the only state or city in the United States that's doing this.
Right.
This is pretty proliferated and infiltrated across the United States, as we know.
So this would make it a higher cost for the flight schools.
It will make it a higher cost and start to weed some of this out of here, because when you sit down and you knock off 120 touch and goes over somebody's heads and flying from Gillespie to Fletcher Hills round trip back in 4 minutes for 16, 17 times, the county could benefit from that through these fees.
Who's responsible if, heaven forbid, there is an accident? Do you feel that the county could have some liability, or the federal government, if one of these student pilots were to crash into...
It's going to be a federal government thing, and then it's going to get passed off to the National Transportation Safety Board like it always does, and we continue to do business as we always have.
Betty, looks like you've got something to say there.
Yeah, because the county airport is tied to FAA. When they accept FAA grants, first of all, it extends the period of time that they have to follow rules from the FAA. And that means they have to guarantee there's a non-discrimination clause where they can't turn businesses away as long as it's aviation related. So maybe they could cut down on the number of schools if they weren't tied to the FAA.
Now, there is another concern that we haven't talked about, that, and that is the security, national security concern that this potentially could pose. I understand, David, that there's been some concern by Homeland Security that potentially a terrorist could use this foreign pilot training program as a means to sneak somebody into the United States, and that one thing that your group has looked at is the possibility of tightening up the requirements, at least making sure that proper background checks are done on the students that come over. Given this, against the backdrop that San Diego did have at least two of the 9/11 terrorists who were flying those planes were here at one point, and certainly around the nation we've seen there were Al-Qaeda terrorists that were in pilot training schools even before 9/11. I understand that there's a proposal before the supervisors that would address some of these security concerns. Can you tell me about what the proposal is and what kind of
reception? I'm going to speak as brief as I know about it. At the last Gillespie Field Development Council, an ordinance from the county supervisor, Jacobs, drafted an ordinance that would be effective within the county and the Gillespie Field enterprise, the airports within that enterprise. And this ordinance will support further vetting as it is vetted through individuals of work cleared through the Transportation Safety Authority, mm-hmm. along with the FBI and others.
Further vetting. Okay.
Further vetted. At the end of the day, what it does is this is the county's, I will call, security blanket, whereas the schools or the academies be required to do their own checking to ensure that these students, cadets, has been properly vetted and will create a certificate for which anyone that will be available. Yeah. And every year you have to renew the certificate, which is a second set of eyes or an added measure to ensuring that all these individuals that's coming through or these cadets are properly vetted.
Now, I understand there's been some resistance to this proposal from some of the flight schools, and I should add that we are extending an invitation to some of the flight schools to come on and tell us their side of the story on a future episode of the East County Magazine show.
I just wanted to say that the flight schools, they do go through a vetting process, but this would be, as David said, an extra blanket of security guaranteeing that they have done it. In other words, making sure to be sure that that had been properly done. And also, I think it would relieve the, if something, God forbid, ever did happen, it would relieve the county of maybe some of the liability.
If they were not to do student training over Gillespie Field, because there are so many houses that have been built up around the airport since it first showed up out there over 50 years ago, where could student pilot training realistically be done instead?
May I entertain that one?
Yes, Dave.
I think we ought to clarify the difference between student pilot and what we are referring to as cadet pilots.
Okay.
Like I say, student pilots, in my mind, are those students that are 40-hour students that onesies and twosies that comes and goes and do something constructive.
Right.
What we have is, and this is more than just the safety and the noise aspect, is an intensity and a density of prerequisites that's laid upon this county as a result of a very compressed international program that requires cadets. Mm-hmm. Like our military cadets go through a compressed high-density program.
Right.
A student pilot, which is going to fly onesies and twosies, will fly the pattern appropriately because their agendas are a lot different. They are not compressed. Four or five cadets in the air simultaneously competing and tail chasing each other to complete these 10-month courses. I mean, you're basically going from realizing the youngest age for a pilot is 16 years old. So we are going to grab some very young individuals that probably don't even have driver's license, and in a 10-month period of time, walking away with commercial license,
wow,
retractable gear, transport qualification. So that's in 10 months. That's an intense prerequisite that's been put up on these homes.
So if you don't want it to be done here in El Cajon,
then you move it where the military does it, which is not over communities and over home.
Okay.
You do it where other cadets are being trained at, out in the middle of the desert somewhere.
Seems like it makes sense to me.
You know, yeah, this is a very compressed program, and that's where people are misleading or misreading what ASAP, Advocate for Safe Airports, policies are representing here. This is not about safety in a sense, but safety as a result of the intensity,
correct,
the density of a very compressed 10-month program that has an incredible prerequisite that's laid upon this community.
Right. And what would you say to those? Some of the critics have also complained that opposing this foreign pilot program is somehow racist. David, do you want to address that one?
They could call it, you know, black as I am, who am I to be racist? And I'm the one that's out here preaching that we need to establish some safety here with this program and look at what it is. At the end of the day, when you sit down and you dial up Gillespie Tower's frequency, mm-hmm, and you listen to who's in the air in the cockpit, let that tell you, be your judgment on who's prejudiced and who's not.
Okay.
I just go by who's talking on the in the cockpit.
Where can people get more information about the ASAP organization?
You can go to our website, which is www.asapgillespiefield.com, or just email us at info@asapgillespie, and you can sign up to get our database email blasts and that sort of thing. I would like to add one thing. We are not trying to create an adversarial situation here. There are many pilots, as you've noted when I gave you the letter, who won't fly at Gillespie anymore. Many pilots who have approached me and basically have said everything from, you've got a freeway over your head, to, the language is an issue. When I can't understand what someone's saying and my life is up there on the line, I'm not flying into Gillespie anymore.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming on the show and joining us today. We appreciate you taking the time to be interviewed for the East County Magazine show on KNSJ.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure being
thank
here.
You.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
As if Thanksgiving Day and the first day of Hanukkah falling on the same date are not coincidence enough, the comet Ison will be at its closest point to the sun, about 750,000 miles away, on that same date, Thursday, November 28th. It may be one of the brightest comets ever observed, but Comet Ison is also at risk of disintegrating as it draws so close to the sun. Grossmont College astronomy professor Ross Cohen says for people who don't have the proper equipment for comet watching at the time of its closest approach to the sun, it's safest to turn to the internet or to television to view images from satellites that will be tracking the comet from various vantage points in space. At its closest point to the sun, called the perihelion, Comet Ison skims past the sun as viewed from Earth, but various satellites have other vantage points from outer space and might even see it cross in front of the sun. If Comet Ison survives the transit, it is expected to display a bright trail of rocks, ice, and other space materials gathered from its origin in the mammoth Oort cloud, a vast expanse of comets surrounding our solar system. Cohen suggests that pre-dawn, in the first several days of December, may be the safest time to see the comet without hurting your eyes, because viewers won't have to contend with the sun's glare. Comet Ison is named for the International Scientific Optical Network, under whose auspices two Russians first spotted the comet in 2012. Because it was visible by telescope for over a year before it would reach perihelion, there is speculation among astronomers that the Comet Ison may be among the brightest ever. Further analysis of its narrow elliptical orbit helped pinpoint its origin to the Oort cloud, which is up to 50,000 times farther from the sun than the Earth is. Since Ison comes from the Oort cloud, it can be reasoned that it has been traveling hundreds of thousands of years in its first trip to our solar system, since some unknown event occurred that knocked it out of its orbit. Cohen said it either had a collision with some other Oort cloud object, or possibly the gravity of a passing star could have perturbed its orbit and sent it heading for the sun. Unlike comets that have gone around the sun before and have survived the trip, Comet Ison faces a more uncertain future as it approaches and reaches perihelion. Cohen said it could disintegrate, and when it comes around, we could see nothing, or the ice could be greatly energized by the sun. All comets leave some sort of trail of dust and water vapor, and the more the material spreads out, the more extravagant that's going to be, unless it gets too hot, and then it would just go bust. Comets can travel for hundreds or even millions of years. The astronomy professor said that the convergence of the American Thanksgiving holiday, the Jewish Hanukkah holiday, and Comet Ison's perihelion is a remarkable triple coincidence. Monday was International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. To mark the occasion, the International Violence Against Women Act was introduced in Congress last week for the third time. Secretary of State John Kerry issued this statement: "Gender-based violence remains an epidemic of global proportions that cuts across every social and economic class, ethnicity, race, religion, and education level. In fact, nearly one-third of women worldwide have experienced some form of sexual or physical violence. This is an unacceptable statistic and must be a wake-up call." The International Violence Against Women Act would make ending violence against women a diplomatic priority for the U.S. and serve as a model for other countries to follow. It would support survivors, as well as programs that hold perpetrators accountable, and also programs to prevent violence. The measure does not seek new funding, but merely affirms policies on how U.S. foreign aid dollars should be spent. Twice before, the International Violence Against Women Act was introduced in Congress, but it failed to win passage, largely due to opposition by Republicans. While it will still face a stiff battle, this time a bipartisan group of House representatives have reintroduced the measure. Globally, violence against women and girls can take horrific forms, including the sexual trafficking of children, forced child marriage, and even the burning of widows. In the United States, the good news is that violence against women fell 65% in the past decade, according to the U.S. Justice Department. But violence against women remains a serious problem in our country. In 2010, 270,000 rapes or sexual assaults occurred against women and girls, and girls ages 16 to 19 are more than four times more likely than the general population to be victims of rape, attempted rape, or sexual assault, according to the Justice Department. The National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey in 2010 suggests even higher numbers. That survey found that 22 million women in the U.S. have been raped in their lifetime, and nearly 1 in 5 women and girls in the U.S. have survived a rape or attempted rape. Now, an online drive has been started to urge members of Congress to support the International Violence Against Women Act. You can find a link to email your congressional members on this issue at futureswithoutviolence.org. That's futureswithoutviolence.org.
The county is reporting an uptick in ticks. Ticks might be tiny, but they can pack a punch when it comes to affecting your health. The county's Health and Human Services Agency warns of an increased possibility of contracting a tick-borne disease. It's important to know that there are several diseases carried by ticks, said Dr. Wilma Wooten, county public health officer. People who work or play in grassy or brushy areas need to take special care to avoid exposure to ticks. In 2012, HHSA received reports of San Diego County residents with confirmed or probable tick-borne illnesses. This included 14 cases of Lyme disease, 2 cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, 2 cases of other rickettsial diseases, which included spotted and typhus fever, and 1 case of ehrlichiosis, a bacterial disease affecting people and animals. Ticks can also carry tularemia and cause tick paralysis. Ticks can be found year-round in San Diego County, but they greatly increase in numbers between November and May. Over the past 2 years, the San Diego County Department of Environmental Health found spotted fever group rickettsia, potentially disease-causing bacteria, in 10 to 20% of tick batches collected in the county. Lyme disease is the most commonly reported tick-borne illness in the United States. It usually starts with a circular red rash at the site of a tick bite. Other symptoms include fatigue, chills, fever, headache, and muscle and joint aches, and swollen lymph nodes. If not treated, the disease can spread to other parts of the body, causing Bell's palsy, loss of muscle tone on either side of the face, along with severe headaches and neck stiffness due to meningitis, as well as joint pain that lasts for months or years. A tick-borne disease caused by bacteria called Rickettsia philippi may be a newer threat in San Diego County. First reported in Northern California in 2008, the illness can be carried by the Pacific Coast tick. The county found evidence of Rickettsia philippi in tick batches it tested from diverse areas in the county, including Sorrento Valley, Escondido, and the Cuyamaca Mountains. A bite from a tick carrying Rickettsia philippi can cause an area of dead skin that looks like a black scab, along with fever, headache, and fatigue. Although this illness has never been reported in San Diego County, people in other parts of California become sick enough to require hospitalization. Tips to avoid ticks include: stay on marked paths, choose wide trails and walk in the center, avoid grassy or brushy areas, wear light-colored, long-sleeve clothing, tuck shirts into pants, and pants into socks or boots. Check clothing, body, and companions for ticks frequently. Remove ticks immediately. Apply insect repellent to clothing and footwear. Keep pets on leash. Treat pets with appropriate sprays, collars, or spot applications labeled for tick control.
Now it's time for the East County Magazine Trivia Quiz. Today we have a special holiday edition of the East County Magazine Trivia Quiz, and I want to welcome our guests today, Raina and Leona.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, Raina and Leona, are you ready for the first question?
Yes, we are.
Okay. A new East County holiday tradition is the Waddle and Trot, which is set for Thanksgiving. What type of event is the Waddle and Trot?
Black Friday shopping?
It must be a new dance.
No, it's not either one of those things. Okay, let me give you some choices. Is it a turkey calling contest in Ramona, a 5K run for charity in Santee, a roundup at the Lakeside Rodeo of turkeys, or a mall walk for shoppers at Grossmont Center?
A turkey calling.
Nope.
A mall walk for shoppers.
That sounds like fun, but no. The right answer. Any more guesses? You're down to two. Is it the Lakeside Rodeo Roundup or the 5K run for charity?
5K run.
That's
Yay,
the right answer.
Yay, I got
answer.
It. Woohoo!
You got it. Okay, one for Raina. Next question. What do wild turkeys and wild pigs in East County have in common?
They get stuffed. Well, actually, that maybe that's a good answer. That wasn't the one I was thinking of.
But. You get eaten, that's for sure.
Okay. You know, I'm going to give you guys both a point for that. You came up with answers I didn't even think of. But just for fun, we'll read the other choices. Is the answer, neither one of them can fly, they're protected from hunting, they're not native to our region, or they are elusive and hard to see?
Pigs don't fly?
They're elusive and hard to see.
Well, the pigs are pretty elusive, but those turkeys are everywhere. You drive through Julian and they're all over the place.
Oh, yeah. They'll chase your car.
The answer is, actually, that neither one of them is native to our region.
I thought of that. What did I say?
Invasive species. Okay,
next. The turkeys come from Foster Farm.
They come from Safeway.
Okay, Leona, Raina. Lemon Grove celebrates the holiday season with an event featuring a giant one of these. What huge item is the centerpiece of their celebration?
Lemon?
Santa?
Nope, it's not a lemon and it's not Santa. Is it a snowman, a Christmas tree, a bonfire, or, well, lemon was one of the guesses, so you're down to three choices left now.
A bonfire.
That's right. It's a bonfire. A giant, huge bonfire. Wow. Yes, kind of like Burning Man in East County, you know. Okay, Alpine's Winter Festival brings something special in for the children. What is it?
I know this.
It's ice skating.
Nope.
Gifts.
No. Vieja says that's nope.
Gifts? Presents?
They may do that. I don't know. But the choices I had were toys from Santa's workshop, snow, reindeer, or penguins.
Reindeer.
Nope, not reindeer.
Penguins?
Leonie?
Snow.
At Christmas? Penguins?
No! It's snow. They actually make it snow and the kids can go sledding and
That's
everything.
That's wonderful.
Okay. Forget Rockefeller Plaza. Where can you find an even larger outdoor ice rink? In fact, it's the largest one in Southern California.
As I said before, it's Viejas.
That's right. Viejas Outlet Mall in Alpine is the correct answer. Okay. El Cajon's Mother Goose Parade each year ends with the arrival of someone special. Who is it?
A goose.
Nope, the goose is first. Is it the Grand Marshal, the mayor, Santa Claus?
The mayor.
San Diego.
It's Santa Claus. Oh. Ho, ho, ho. Okay, which holiday celebration is held each year on the top of Mount Helix? You don't know?
Happy Helix Christmas.
Is it a choral concert, a Handel's Messiah, a holiday wine tasting festival, a community caroling party, or reindeer races?
Reindeer races.
That would be a lot of fun.
It would be. I want to go.
Leona, do you have a guess?
Well, I would think in Mount Helix is probably tasting wine.
No, it's a caroling party.
Oh, caroling, that's good.
I live there. You walk up and go caroling all the way up the hill. Okay, where can you find Scrooge every December in East County?
At my house.
At the bank.
At the bank. I don't know that. I may be both. The answers were, the choices were, Grossmont College, Julian Town Hall, Lamplighter Theater in La Mesa, or Santee City Hall.
Lamplighter Theater?
Nope.
Santee City Hall.
Actually, it's the Julian Town Hall. They do a production of it every Christmas. Two more questions. Okay.
I'm not doing too well.
La Mesa's annual Christmas in the Village evokes a bygone era. Which one is it?
Era?
The 19th century.
19th century. Well, you're kind of close. Is it the Wild West, the Gold Rush days, the golden age of silent movies in the 1920s, or is it the Victorian era?
Victorian.
Raina is right. It's the Victorian era. Okay.
Oh, my.
Last one. One East County facility does something very unusual with pumpkins and turkeys every holiday season. How are they used?
They smash them?
Actually, San Diego State does do a pumpkin drop, but they don't drop turkeys. Thankfully for turkeys.
Well, that's good.
They drop turkeys out of a
helicopter.
Nope, not that I know of. The choices are, do they use them for target practice at a shooting range?
Oh, my gosh.
Decorating and displaying at an art gallery, auctioning off for an East County charity, or feeding hungry lions at a big cat rescue facility?
Auctioning off.
No.
Feeding the big cats?
Yes, that's right.
Oh,
that's
my
the
gosh.
Right answer.
I think the most unlikely.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us for another edition of the East County Magazine Trivia. Thank you. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.
December 2nd is Cyber Monday, when online retailers offer specials for holiday shoppers. The internet makes holiday shopping so easy. No fighting for parking spaces at jam-packed malls, no waiting in endless lines to get to the register. But even if you consider yourself a pro, shopping online isn't without risks. These tips from the U.S. government at usaid.gov can help you protect yourself and your finances as you hunt for that perfect gift. 1. Use a credit card rather than a debit card. Credit card payments can be withheld if there's a dispute with a store and if the card is stolen. You don't have to pay more than $50 of fraudulent charges. But with a debit card, you can't withhold payments. The store is paid directly from your bank account. And if your card is stolen, you could be liable for up to $500, depending on when you report it. 2. Find out if the public Wi-Fi hotspot you're using at a coffee shop or bookstore is secure. If it's not, your payment information could be compromised over the network. 3. It's risky not to read the terms of service agreement before you buy online. You could inadvertently sign up for subscriptions or get hit with additional fees or restrictions. 4. Be careful if you're buying event tickets online as gifts. Some venues may practice restricted ticketing, requiring the same credit card used in the online purchase to be shown to get into the event. And 5. Use caution buying digital assets like books and music. They can't be given away as gifts if they've been downloaded to your account. Instead, purchase a gift card for the book or music site or check with the company. Some services have ways to gift an item, but it varies depending on the provider. For more advice on safe online shopping and being a savvy consumer this holiday season and all year long, check out the Consumer Action Handbook and other helpful resources at USAID.gov.
To help brighten the holidays for families in need, the Salvation Army in El Cajon will be holding the 38th Annual East County Toy and Food Drive this year. If your family needs help with food or gifts for your children this holiday season, you can apply for help by filling out an application on Saturday, November 23rd, or on Saturday, December 7th, from 9 a.m. to noon and from 1:30 to 3 o'clock at the Salvation Army offices. The offices are located at 1011 East Main Street in El Cajon. The toys are for children ages 12 and under. Space is limited and you must appear in person to apply. No applications will be completed without all verifications requested. To get details, call 619-440-4683, extension 401. You, your group, or your organization are welcome to drop off donations to the Salvation Army location as well.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. Julian kicks off its old-fashioned holiday celebration Saturday, November 30th, at this event, which features Christmas carols performed by local vocalists. The festivities begin at 1 p.m. The tree lighting will be at Pioneer Park at 5 p.m. Ramona Ranch Black Friday and Motorcycle Run will be happening this weekend. First, on Friday the 29th, there will be a hometown Black Friday in Ramona's Old Town area in the East End. Starting at 8 a.m., shoppers can stroll down historic Main Street between 5th and 8th for sidewalk sales and unique gifts offered by local shop owners. Then folks can head up to Ramona Ranch Winery, located 3 miles east of Ramona's Old Town, for wine and pizza. Ramona Ranch Winery will be open from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. for tastings, and Trezette's Catering will be serving up flatbread pizza and salad from noon to 4 p.m. Then on Saturday the 30th, the Ramona Ranch Winery will be set up for Ramona's first annual Holiday House Motorcycle Run to collect donations to help local San Diego charities. Participants and spectators meet up at 9 a.m. at 780 Main Street in Ramona, bringing along new toys, new clothing, new household items, gift cards, or financial contributions. Santee's second annual Waddle and Trot 5K will be ready for runners and supporters on Thursday, November 28th at 8 a.m. This fun family event hosted by Pathways Community Church is intended for runners and walkers of every fitness level, and all proceeds will go to Santee Santas and the Santee Food Bank. A fun run is planned for kids age 10 and under and begins at 9 a.m. within the Pathways parking lot. The Boughs of Holly and Giveaway Jolly at Grossmont Center will be held the day after Thanksgiving on Friday, November 29th, complete with Santa's arrival, giveaways, and a snow flurry show. Fusion Glass Gallery and Studio is hosting its annual holiday show and 10th anniversary party on Saturday, November 30th at 7 p.m. on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa. Guests can enjoy a feast for the eyes with a bounty of beautiful artworks by local artists, while feasting on appetizers, sipping wines and beers, and enjoying a champagne toast. Local jazz musician Bo Downey will perform, and there will be a photo booth. The dress theme for the evening is sparkles. A reenactment of the Battle of San Pasquale will be staged at the San Pasquale Battlefield State Park on Sunday, December 1st, along with living history presentations, children's activities, and a military encampment. The event gets underway at 10:30 a.m. with the battle reenactments at 11:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. The event ends at 3:30 p.m. San Pasquale Valley Road in Escondido is the location. A new group meditation will be starting up in Acumba Hot Springs. Saturday, November 30th is the first of planned weekly sessions for Saturdays at the Energy Works on Old Highway 80 in Acumba Hot Springs. The meditation will be held every Saturday after that from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. and includes a guided relaxation meditation and light refreshments. Now for some ongoing holiday events. A Julian specialty, the Julian Christmas Train Express, will be running through December 31st, where guests can take a one-mile train ride to an 1870 gold rush mine with some surprises. Viejas Outlet Skating Ring in Alpine is open each holiday season and winter, where skaters and non-skaters alike may enjoy this outdoor ice rink, which is larger than the famed Rockefeller Center rink in New York and the largest in Southern California. The Santa Train, the North Pole Limited, is accepting reservations now for its ongoing Christmas rail journey every Saturday and Sunday from December 6th through December 21st. Starting at the Campo Railway Museum with fun and good cheer, guests will board the Limited. As it leaves the depot, Santa's elves will serve cookies and hot chocolate. An onboard book reading of a popular Christmas story leads up to the arrival at Santa's Workshop, where the train will stop just long enough for Santa to board the train for the return trip to Campo. Santa will be visiting with all of the children on the train on the way back. Reservations are required in advance. Now, a preview of some upcoming events in the next few weeks. Santa and snow are in the forecast Sunday, December 8th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the annual Santa at the Lakes at Santee Lakes Recreation Preserve. There will be tons of snow for sledding, Santa visits, and enjoying s'mores by the fire. They will also have pony rides, a petting zoo, boat rides, hay rides, holiday art activities, carnival rides, and inflatables. Kids can make holiday crafts, including reindeer hats, holiday bag decorating, bird feeders, ornaments, Santa's stocking factory, and cookie decorating. Holiday music and decorations round out the event. A holiday wine trail will be held on Saturday and Sunday, December 7th and 8th in Ramona. Guests will receive 5 tastings at each of 6 wineries, 1 catered food pairing at each, and their own holiday wine trail glass. Wine trail riders can spread the trail out over the 2-day weekend or choose which day works best. On Sunday, there will be live music at Ramona Ranch. The San Diego Concert Band launches its 25th anniversary season with a holiday concert at the Joan B. Kroc Theater called Joyous Celebration on Tuesday, December 17th at 7 p.m. Under the direction of Roy Anthony Jr., the San Diego Concert Band will perform a variety of holiday and winter season selections, including some band members' favorites from the past 25 years. Alpine Village Christmas Parade of Lights rolls out along with a snow festival on Friday, December 6th at 6:30 p.m. This event is sponsored by the Alpine Chamber. That's all for this week. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festival and events section at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
For the past 8 years, the Alpine Women's Club has sponsored its Christmas in Alpine home tour. However, this year, the group has only one house for its tour and is seeking additional homes to showcase in Alpine. The fundraiser helps to provide scholarships that the club gives away each year. Since 1950, the Alpine Women's Club has given away more than $95,000 to exceptional Alpine graduating seniors, said Carla Anderson, president of the Alpine Women's Club. She added, "We are reaching out to the community and looking for Alpine residents who love to decorate for the holidays and would enjoy sharing their decorating skills with others." The event is scheduled for Saturday, December 14th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. If you are interested in being part of this festive event, you will also be invited to the club's Christmas party starting at 3 p.m. at the Alpine Women's Club located in historic Town Hall Building. There will be food, refreshments, and surprises. For more information, contact Carla Anderson at 445-2055 extension 11 or email the Alpine Women's Club at AOL.com.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.